Hello and welcome to Ready for Nintendo, episode 452. I am your host, James Jones. With me today, Greg.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Guillaume.
Hello.
And subbing in for our friend, Miss John, is Karen.
Hello.
Thanks for being here, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
On such short notice.
Yeah, very short notice. Like 10 minutes ago.
Hey, do you feel like being on a podcast about Nintendo?
I always feel like being on a Nintendo podcast.
Good. Oh. I'll keep
it's my default mode.
I'll keep that in mind. So, new business. Actually, I wanted to go ahead and, Karen, why don't you tell us about Yoshi's Woolly World?
Okay. Yeah, Guillaume got it, last week? We decided to rip it open right away. I would say that, I haven't really played any of the Yoshi games before. So the most comparable experience I have is probably the Kirby games, because it has that, you know, especially the wool, component to it has, it definitely feels like the, what was the name? Kirby's Yarn Adventure.
Epic Yarn.
Epic Yarn, of course. How could I forget? So it definitely felt like that, but I think it definitely was more challenging. The first level, the first world is pretty comparable to any of the Kirby levels, but, I noticed a really steep learning curve after the second world, or after the first world, I should say. And I think Guillaume felt the same way. We're playing co-op, so we're, again, constantly getting in each other's way, which is part of the fun and frustration of playing co-op games. But overall, the experience was amazing. I really enjoyed the game. I really love the textures and just how creative the game is with, with the character design and the level design.
Has a lot of little touches, like the shy guys are not carrying spears this time around. They're, they're crochets.
Crochet hooks.
Hooks. And, you throw a ball of yarn at them and it sticks under a crochet and then they're kind of powerless, right? And sometimes, like, you'll have some with those spears that they're tied to balloons and you pop the balloons and they fall down and they their crochet hooks
they stick into the ground.
But the shy guys are holding on to them and they're just like kicking their legs powerlessly. So it's awfully cute.
It's very cute.
And we've been playing co-op and it's just it's an experience for sure, because the camera doesn't always seem to know which player it wants to follow, and so that leads to some annoying moments where we're not exactly at the same height in the level, and then like I'm trying to go find this secret or where I think there's a secret at the bottom, and Karen is the level clearly wants you to go up. And I'm not telling Karen, oh, I think there's a secret there. I just do my own thing. But then, she climbs up. Yeah. And like she climbs up and the camera pans up and suddenly, whoops, okay. I got turned into an egg and I lost all my yarn balls. And I don't think I lose health, but still, like, it's just like, oh, come on, game. Focus on me. I'm the important one here.
Yeah, exactly. I really can't tell that Guillaume's the primary or dominant player in the game, and I think that's what we found most frustrating.
I think you're selling yourself short here.
I'm kidding.
He's the one looking into a hole, so I think you're fine.
That's true. It just seems that it doesn't take much for that to happen, for you to go off screen, to get to the edge of the screen and for the camera to start following you, and the other person gets cut off and then turns into an egg yarn, or a flying egg, and then loses all, you lose all your yarn balls. So that's probably my only criticism of the game. I don't know if Guillaume has more, but,
seems to become more of an important issue as you go on, because the early levels are pretty horizontal.
That's true.
That problem doesn't really pop up. But later on, like, there's this level where you're hanging on to a curtain and you're sliding down a pole. Like, it's a roller coaster level with a curtain. Yes. And
that's true. And it's very problematic in that level because it's so easy to get separated.
Yeah, like one of those.
I'm starting to imagine what the special course that uses that mechanic would be like in co-op.
Oh, we've only unlocked the special level in World 3 so far, which was amazing. But yeah,
they're
anyway.
All thoroughly worth seeing. But that raises some serious questions about how well they might function in co-op.
Right, like we for some stuff in the game, we might just decide to pass the controller and go, you know, single player, and because co-op in that case, like it just becomes so frustrating because we've had instances where, you know, one of us grabs on the curtain and the other one, you know, doesn't manage to grab onto it and so falls to their death, but the camera decides to follow the guy who's falling to his death. So it's just like, come on. Like,
it
surely
wants you to feel bad.
Yeah, well, you know, and like, so you've got someone else off screen, like going on, like, you know, who managed to survive, except the camera doesn't allow that person to survive. So it's just some problems like that have been frustrating. But overall, it's a pretty damn good game.
If one of you is using the gamepad, does it not care? Does it not give you more camera flexibility, or does it continue to just persist with whomever it decides is the leader?
We've been both using the Wii remotes.
Oh, okay.
It's just a superior way to control the game, I find.
It is
the
definitely
motion
preferable for the aiming, so I can imagine that would be the case. But I don't think the gamepad does anything different, as far as I know. I've never tested it, but...
Right, it would just be player one, player two, and no, the camera doesn't follow automatically player one more than player two.
Mm.
Bit of a missed opportunity. It could have been one way of alleviating these sorts of things. And of course, the motion controls could have been on the gamepad as well. So yeah, it's a bit odd.
It is.
Yeah, it does seem very underutilized piece of functionality for being the core component of the system.
Yeah. So we've been enjoying it. Sometimes, you know, there has been more frustration than in other levels. I might have hissed a shit game at some point.
You did. But, you definitely. You did not hiss it. You yelled it.
I need some more details on this story.
That's the first time I've actually seen you say, "We have to stop playing this game." Usually it's me. Usually it's I'm the one who has to stop. But you weren't in a really good mood to play that night. So.
Yeah, but you've been really, you know, like every night, like, what are we going to do? Oh, let's play Yoshi's Woolly World. So
it's true. Yeah.
You've been really into it. So I think that, like, we did try to download on my hacked Wii. You know, I downloaded the ROM for Yoshi's Island on the Super Nintendo, but the emulator for the Wii is terrible. And so it leads to the first, there's a very early on, there's a cave with waterfalls in the background. And as soon as you hit that part of the game, the frame rate takes a huge dip, and it just kind of becomes like, it gives you a headache, you know, like the it's not pleasant to play. So
no, made me dizzy, right? It goes way too fast, and so it kind of gives you motion sickness.
Right. So you seem to be enjoying the game up to that point, but I'm probably going to invest in the GBA version. On the Wii U, and because I think you would really enjoy it. Like it's very much the same type of game, like the same type of level design, and of course Yoshi's Woolly World does have a lot of new stuff, but the core gameplay is in Yoshi's Island, and actually I think you'll be surprised just how much of Yoshi's Island of Yoshi's Woolly World was inspired by Yoshi's Island, you know. Mm-hmm. Stuff that you wouldn't expect the Super Nintendo to be capable of, like the rolling a giant ball of snow, and you know, as if you're rolling up a snowman. Mm-hmm. So that was in the Super Nintendo game and stuff like that. So
it's also a very adorably styled game with the Absolutely. With the crayon visuals.
Yeah,
actually, I talked about it a couple months ago when I did my tour of the games that. The Mario games that I didn't have a lot of experience with or hadn't played in a while, and I actually really enjoyed it. I didn't really feel the loss of buttons that came with it being on the GBA, so they did a pretty good job. Because some of those Super Nintendo to GBA ports, like, you could really feel there was buttons missing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel it on that one. So, like, yeah, it's a cool game. Like, I'm glad that you get the same vibes from Woolly World that you're getting from that game, because that makes me feel a little bit more inclined to go pick it up, say, you know, before the craziness hits in another week or so.
Right. And one of the things, like early on, we were playing and I kept going into these conspicuously empty spaces in the levels and finding these secrets. And Karen was like, how do you know there's something there? And I'm just like, well, it's empty.
It's the Yoshi sense. It's a lot like people talk about Metroid sense, you know, where it's like right. That bit suspicious. I'm definitely going to bomb that first. And what do you know that, that you know, it does lead somewhere. It's when you get, when, if you've played Yoshi's Island a lot, especially yeah. I did, you know, I got all of the 100 scores and everything. You get a sense of like, okay, there's a little bit that's recessed there or a little bit that's got a little alcove there. You naturally just want to see what happens when you go in that little space, you know, because you mm-hmm. feel like there's a reason why it's there. And usually there'll be a cloud that's triggered, which is, you know, essentially the equivalent of Yoshi's equivalent of the invisible blocks in Mario that are triggered, you know, when mm-hmm. you hit them. So yeah, it's, you know, it really does follow on from that game. Even it's probably the first one that really feels like it delivers on the promise of that game, even though it's 20 years old.
yeah it's not, you know, I've played Yoshi's Island DS, I've played Yoshi's New Island, and it's just our tune was just not very good at making Yoshi games. And finally, I feel like this game is the first sequel to do the original justice and to improve on it. And I wasn't initially super impressed by it because, as I was saying, like the types of secrets are very, the type of level design is very similar. Like I felt like, okay, so now it's Yarn, but it's still Yoshi's Island. And I was yeah. like, I wish they had done more with it. But towards the end of the game, without spoiling anything, they really have more, they take more freedom. With the level design and the things they do with different materials, and it's fantastic, you know.
Yeah, I was quite pleasantly surprised with the fact they kept coming up with sort of level concepts based on the fabric aesthetic, you know, the mechanics of fabrics all right. the way to the end. It wasn't like, okay, let's establish the aesthetic and then kind of forget about it once the game gets underway. They kept delivering on that.
And it was more than just visual embellishment.
It actually kind of would tie into the mechanics of certain kinds of platforms or certain kinds of enemies and all that. So mm-hmm. I was really pleased with that part of it. I was kind of worried that they just kind of that drift into the background naturally as maybe the difficulty becomes more of the emphasis or something.
Yeah.
So you say it's a co-op game, it works pretty well. Is it 1-2 player, or can you just keep dropping multiplayer in there? Is it a 2-player limit?
No, it's 2 players only.
Oh, darn.
Well, it's enough. I mean, because when we... You know, like, there's many ways that we can interfere with each other. You know, we can throw eggs.
Chaos.
I know. We can throw eggs at each other and just, you know, it bumps the other person back a little bit. And that can be, you know, sometimes fatal or sometimes really annoying.
That's really easy to swallow each other, too. You can just, you know, and then you turn the other person into an egg and then they have to, you know, press the buttons in order to get out of it. And that can be frustrating.
And then get back all their yarn balls and... Yeah, like sometimes, like when it's at the wrong time, it can be frustrating. Other times, I kept like swallowing up your Yoshi, and it was like you couldn't escape my vicinity. Like there kept being enemies, like bullet bills, you know, passing overhead, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna grab that bullet bill, and then you would jump trying to get away, and then like, oh no, okay. my Yoshi had other plans. And,
yeah, there's definitely some of that in Triforce Heroes, you know, where there's some bits where it's kind of questionable design, where it packs you in a bit too close. There's mm-hmm. this boss fight where you're kind of on a minecart and there's a boss on another minecart chucking bombs at you. And the thing is, that level has boomerangs. So sometimes people are like, oh, well, I haven't got a bomb to throw back. I'll stun him with the boomerang. But this then snags a bomb out of the air and brings it back, which blows all three of you up at once. And that's triple damage on your shared health bar. You know, it's just like, well, ouch. Maybe you shouldn't design it so that we're this close together.
Wow. But no, ultimately, I think it did make... I don't know. I think it did make collecting 100% of stuff in the levels easier in some cases.
Oh yeah, the original Yoshi's Island, or than playing by yourself.
Yeah, no, I mean playing co-op. Like like being able to turn each other into eggs and stuff like that helped sometimes. But I think mostly we benefited from the fact that we had almost all the time like 12 yarn balls in play, so we very seldom ran out of them to collect stuff.
And even then, the thing I like about the game is there's so much, and this is probably common to the other Yoshi games as well, but, you know, we could finish a level and not collect everything and go back, and I was quite happy to do that. You know, the game forces you to play through it several times, right, in order to get everything. So, you know, mm-hmm. I really enjoy that aspect of it.
Right, that's actually one of the differences. This is the first one to do that. Like, what you collected stays collected. In the other games, you have to do it in one go.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, well,
New Island kind of half-measured it, where if you got all the flowers, that would count. Or if you got all the red coins, that would count. But you didn't have to get all the flowers and all the red coins at the same time.
How magnanimous of them.
That is a bit of a weird half measure. This, I feel, is the sort of natural thing to do.
Absolutely, because if you're exploring every nook and cranny, you're already probably going to get all the flowers, all the red coins. So, yeah, it doesn't really help you all that much. Here, it's much more relaxed, it's much more lenient, and definitely an improvement for the best.
Yeah, I hope this isn't the end for Yoshi and Goodfeel. That they'll do another one day, because this is really great. It looks great. It's first console Yoshi game in so long and all that. But it would be nice to see them branch out a bit again. I mean, I know that's kind of what they did with Yoshi's Story, and people don't like that all that much because it went a bit too kind of far away from the Yoshi's Island template. But, you know, as nice as this is as a follow-up and a kind of tribute in places to the original Yoshi's Island, I think it's, you know, the thing that was wonderful about Yoshi's Island at the time was that it was not anything like a Super Mario sequel you were expecting. So, you know, to have it just be iterated on, I think is, not the natural thing to do with Yoshi. Hopefully they can do something different with him. I mean, they managed to do a whole bunch of different stuff with Kirby. You know, they put him in all kinds of games that still have some kind of, you know, kernel of Kirby appeal.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Yoshi got a Super Scope game, got two puzzle games, got
we came out of the gate gangbusters. No one disputes that.
This is our new thing.
But it's been, you know, he's gradually kind of diminishing. Whereas Kirby's still, you know, he's still so malleable, he ends up in everything.
Well,
you know,
literally and figuratively,
and all that kind of stuff.
I think because so little of what Kirby is defined by his shape, essentially. Because it is a stand-in. I mean, it is literally a stand-in that they had built.
That's how his character was born, right?
So it's... What he does in the game is in no way dictated by what he looks like. Whereas Yoshi, there's certain, not to over science this, there's certain biomechanics of what Yoshi is. And you can only build a game around, but so much.
It's more defined, sure. Yeah. Right. You know, I should say just the fact that, you know, there's so many Yoshi levels in Mario Maker is kind of like bringing him back as well. That's kind of an honorary Yoshi game. If only there was a Yoshi tag that you could put on the on levels and just search levels for Yoshi, but I've still ended up playing loads.
Yeah. Guillaume.
Yes.
You've also been playing something else, haven't you?
Yes, I have. In my spare time, I've been... Spare time. Why? When?
So you're fine. You're fine.
Anyway, I've been playing a lot of the Legend of Legacy. And
it's good because there's a lot to play.
Yeah, well, actually, no, because I've heard from another friend that like he finished it in about 30 hours. So it's not the, I don't know, I'm probably not going to finish it in that time, but it's not the lengthiest RPG.
Let me check. Go ahead.
Okay. But so I'm about like 27 hours in. I'm pretty far into the game, and it's very easy to start ranting about all the weird stuff that the game does, and that just makes no sense. It's a little bit harder to explain like why exactly I put 27 hours into it. But first things first, the ranting about the weird stuff. Like, turns out, the game doesn't tell you this, but turns out that when you call these, air, water, or fire spirits to be able to cast spells, you're also changing the, the ratio of those spirits in the air, like in battle or something. And then you switch the balance of these elements one way or the other, and that has effects. So if you've got like more water elements in the air, then I think that it's a elemental damage is halved. When you've got air, it's physical damage that's halved, and when you've got fire, physical damage is doubled. And you know, like, you can think, that's probably pretty easy to notice and figure out, but not really, because for the longest time you only have water elements, and so you're into battle and you start using your spells, and all of a sudden, like, attacks that used to deal 200 damage now only deal 100, and you're not sure why, because you've been maybe casting buffs and debuffs, maybe you've been switching up your attacks. Like, there could be a multitude of reasons why your attacks are not as effective as they were. So it's just because the game doesn't tell you anything and doesn't really keep track of is this buff still in effect or not, it's so confusing.
So for reference, my clear time is 34 hours. I would say that the thing about it is that because there's sort of a neutral position based on where you are and what the elemental balance is, it's always sort of slowly drifting back towards that. Like,
yes.
And so it's hard sometimes to keep track, because you may have a situation where it bounces between all three in the course of a turn. Like, one character may go and do something that changes it, and then you do something, and then the enemy changes it, and then you change it again, and you may experience the balance three or four different ways in a single turn.
Right. So,
and it affects both parties as well.
It does.
Even if you've got control of water, both of you are half elemental damage, which with an elementalist is something you really had to keep track of.
Absolutely, yeah. And especially, like, I don't know, like, physical damage. Sometimes you're like, okay, these enemies are weak and I don't fear them. You know, like, I've dispatched this exact number and type of enemies before. Like, this exact same group of enemies before. So, like, I don't have to pay attention. I'm just going to just trounce them, but then you don't notice that, oh, okay, the fire elements are predominant, and so they deal double damage, you do too, but then if they act first, then they decimate you, and you're just, oh, oops. So in a way, like, it's confusing and it's annoying when it works against you, but at the same time, I kind of see what they were going for. Like, in an RPG, often you're doing battle after battle after battle, and when you know the enemy's strengths and weaknesses and you know how to deal with them, then it's done, right? Like, you're not really learning anything new next time you encountered them. You know what to do, and it's just, it kind of becomes repetition. It becomes rote.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say that in the second to last dungeon, is quite a bit different. But the second to last dungeon, I was encountering enemies that I had seen four or five dungeons earlier in the game. And to what end? All it did was mean I had to fight more of these battles, because the cost for running away is so staggeringly high that I just had to sit there and grind these guys under heal over and over again.
Yeah, but at the same time, what I was going to say is that when the battle, when the conditions for the battle change so much, are so dynamic, then you have to stay on your toes. Like, you constantly have to pay attention, and it keeps the battles fresh to a certain degree. But at the same time, the game, there's a lot of repetition still. There's some grinding to be done. They sure love their palette swaps. So that's also something you have to keep in mind, like, oh, did I deal with these birds before? Whoa, no, these are much stronger. I guess they're pink and not orange, I do appreciate what they've done, like what they were trying to do. And I'm still enjoying the game a lot. Like, it's just battle after battle. There's not a whole ton of story. But I keep playing it. It's really scratching that RPG itch, that I've had for a while, because, you know, I failed to get into Final Fantasy VII. I failed to get into Shin Megami Tensei Soul Survivors, Digital Souls, whatever it's called.
Soul Hackers.
Soul Hackers. And so, yeah, I've been looking for a good RPG to sink my teeth into. And like this, even though it's so weird in many ways, it's still familiar in a lot of ways. And it's still like that kind of JRPG comfort food that I was looking for. So I keep going back to it, and just I'm enjoying it a lot.
Good. And, I mean, I'm glad that you're having a good time with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have a good time with it?
Who's magnanimous now, James?
I did beat it. Like to your point, though, there is this kind of sense of, like, why am I still playing this sometimes? Like, because you sit there and you're like, okay, I'm beating up these dumb things for the thousandth time. And my strategy that I developed is even more kind of repetitious than it needed to be, because I found this pattern that just worked for me every time, and that was I shift the balance of the elementals to green and I keep it there and I never let my foot off the gas, and essentially my elementalist's only job is to make sure it stays green. And then I get blue just to get the minor health buff, but I don't keep it going. So essentially every battle became the same strategy, and the problem is it worked.
Right.
Like it shouldn't have worked. It worked on the last boss battle, it worked on, you know, the last set of enemies I fought. It's just the battles ended up taking forever because everybody's damage was half, and it was just, I mean, that's the other thing. There's a very Radiant Historia thing going on here, where there's all these formations, there's all these ways you can make the characters sort of do what you want them to do. There's a lot of complexity in the battle, but ultimately I found a scenario or a formula that works, and I repeat it a lot against a lot of enemies, way too many enemies, and the battles take a long time.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, oh, hey, I remember this. It got on my nerves last time.
Yeah. And the game definitely favors using the green elements, because otherwise you can't really use your skills in battle. You run out of MP too fast.
Yeah.
So
versus if you have it fully cranked and you're getting 7 or 8 MP back a turn, and your other characters can just spam their most powerful move over and over again.
Right. So it's definitely to your advantage. Still, right now, 27 hours in, I'm still enjoying it. We'll see. I'm probably like in the last stretch. And my main character is Filmia, and like he's a frog prince.
Yes.
And he's awesome. He's just, I don't know, like he feels like playing someone who takes Dungeons and Dragons way too seriously. You know, he speaks like, forsooth, let us be mindful that we might not end up becrispened ourselves. And just, you know, like he's the type of person who'll just shout like, huzzah! And it's perfect. It's perfect for this type of game. It makes me get into the game more. Like it actually kind of improves the feeling that I'm an explorer, just, you know, having an adventure, because, you know,
because
he
this
takes
idiot.
It so yeah he takes it so seriously. It's awesome.
So I'm not gonna tell you how far you are in the game, but I'm curious, like, where are you right now?
I've kind of wasted a little bit of time.
Normal for this game.
Yeah, but just grinding a bit. So I did the 4 kind of east, west, south, and north mountains. Plateaus. And there's a couple more areas than any that I need to explore fully, and they're kind of difficult. So I need to take more time to grind more. So
yeah, the plateaus are relatively easy compared to the marsh that you get at roughly the same time, which is just brutal. The one thing that I don't understand about this game is that after you clear the marsh and the area after the marsh, there's no real indication of where you're supposed to go. And this happens a couple times during the game. The map salesman doesn't have anything for you. There's no other map you find by searching. The game more or less just kind of says, all right, now what?
It's up to you to kind of try different areas and escape when you see that you're no match for it, for the enemies.
But at this point, I mean, there's no areas left to go. Like, you've seen them all and you've beaten them all, and there's no clear indication where you're supposed to be. And ultimately, I just went online and saw like a forum thread. People like, where do I go now? And then finally somebody just said, oh, you go to this one place that you went to a long time ago, and this one thing from like 20 hours ago is open now. It's like, oh, okay, game. That happens actually fairly early in the game with the abandoned village, but this is a much later occurrence. So,
right.
It's like, okay, I get it, but at the same time, it's like, man, they could have given you something here.
Yeah.
Because I probably lost 5 hours just wondering, going, where am I going? to your point, it is a good game.
It is.
It's just got some stuff where you're like, why'd you do it that way?
Yeah. So, I'm going to finish it soon. I'm enjoying it. I think if you're looking for a classic RPG, get Etrian Odyssey. And if you've played Etrian Odyssey, then get this.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot similar between the two. Mm. Cool. So, Greg.
Yep. Well, I played the Fatal Frame demo, but you've also played that, haven't you, James?
Yeah, and we can talk about it now. That's fine.
Okay. I just did it today, actually. I had to get around to downloading it first, to set in the Wii to download it overnight.
It is fairly hefty.
I got around to it today, and I haven't made a decision or anything about whether to pick it up. I mean, the one downside with it being predominantly digital, here it's not a digital exclusive, it does have a limited Fancy Dan edition, but that is obviously even more expensive than it is on the eShop.
Yes.
So there's less chance that it's gonna, become available somewhere at an affordable price when those are your only two options, or indeed your only option in America. So I'm not sure whether I'm ready to take the plunge for full price yet. But I quite enjoyed the demo. Although I kind of know the thing is with a horror game like this, when you're dealing with really serious themes like, suicide, it kind of ups the ante in the sense that, on the one hand, it could be more kind of affecting in its storytelling, but on the other hand, it sets a higher standard for itself. You know, I mean, if you're dealing with silly stuff like Resident Evil,
right, zombies,
you could just have stupid stuff like that. Little
I don't know.
Guy.
I don't think bacteriological warfare is to be taken lightly, Greg.
Yeah,
I don't like your attitude at all.
Depends on what dictator you ask, Guillaume, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the thing here. I mean, like, there is serious stuff in the Resident Evil games, but it's just cause it's channeling the old B movies, and I mean, as they went along, they just got progressively more insane. I mean, yeah. RE4, that little Napoleon guy. What the hell was that? So it's just like, it could be kind of tense and like, the spring-loaded cat stuff, but I don't know how like disturbing it is because it's just so silly and kind of fantastical.
Right.
Whereas you take something like Silent Hill Shattered Memories, which deals with kind of family issues, psychological stuff, that can be a lot more sort of emotionally effective. But like I said, the quality of the storytelling's got to be up to it if you're going to deal with that sort of legitimacy. You can't just sort of have it descended silly. So I'm not sure about it, whether it's going to be, is it going to tell the story well enough over the balance of it to kind of make me believe that it can respectfully kind of handle these themes. I don't know whether you had any thoughts on that.
In the very early, it seems to be leaning heavily towards, whoa, suicide, look out, spooky. Now it is touching on elements of Japanese culture, specifically, how suicide is viewed in that country and this sort of weird cultural thing that suicide is. It's obviously not a normal thing anywhere, but there's a kind of a different sense of it there and how it's portrayed culturally. And it's very much in line with that. But it is how the game handles the first, the second proper death you see. Because the first death you see appears to be ritual murder, which is just, all right, that's how we're going to go in this game, huh? But you see a character take their own life in a very disturbing way. But then at the same time, it sort of then dials it back and says, well, actually, ghosts.
And yeah, see, this is kind of what I'm talking about in terms of the tension there. Like, is it, I don't know whether it's going to end up occupying a sort of unhappy kind of medium, you know?
Well, I mean, like, I think even if it was serious, it would be very unhappy.
Yes, I don't mean in the most literal sense.
Oh, yeah.
But no, it's, you know what I mean? That this kind of, some of these fantastical elements might feel more jarring when you're dealing with this kind of the serious theme like that.
But I think also maybe it's speaking a little bit to Japanese psychology, which I obviously can't speak to, being neither well studied in Japanese mythos or psychology. But yeah. I think certainly it speaks a little bit towards, you know, their thought on death and dying, because there's a the overarching theme here appears to be that these restless spirits are essentially preying on those who are already emotionally fragile, and in so doing they are taking their own lives, which is upsetting to that dichotomy you're speaking of, if it's treated literally. If you go and take it back and make it more symbolic, I guess it works more effectively. But I don't necessarily know that Tecmo Koei, the purveyors of Dead or Alive Beach Volleyball, are really the players to whom I turn for deep psychological analysis portrayed as a sort of metaphor.
No, exactly. That's the thing. So on one hand, I feel like the demo kind of made it seem more interesting than your typical kind of impression of a horror game might be. But on the other hand, it's kind of a bit of trepidation, like, yeah, maybe this is beyond them to do it well. It's I don't know.
Definitely when you get to see someone's inner thoughts, and that happens a lot when they I'm blanking on her name, but there's a character who you're sort of working with early on, and she's she's dropping notes, essentially. And you can see that she's kind of got these really deep issues that she's not touching on herself, but, you know, she's developed an extreme emotional dependence. You start to become aware of the fact that she's attempted to take her own life before. And then ultimately, you know, the divine hand, or I guess the I would say the Deus Ex Machina, but in fact it's a ghost.
The profane hand.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like that was really the cause anymore, even though the game is quite explicit about, yeah, that's it. That's the problem. It, you know, it seems much more like, well, maybe that was just sort of the spirit sort of doing what she wanted anyway, because the game's quite explicit. You know, if you go to this place, you're going here because you want to die. I don't know. It knows. It seems to be aware that the dichotomy or the line it has to walk is very, very tight. And, you know, how it sort of sets up her willingness to die is established well enough that if she had done it without the presence of a ghost, it'd be totally believable.
Yeah. No, it's not like out of the blue or anything. At all. It's very much grounded in the story, but like I said, it's just you know, how they're gonna really is just something you'd have to see the whole game, how it handles it. You know, probably be some moments that are more satisfactory than others, you know, everything like that is probably you know, not going to be a straight line. So it's difficult to get, but I mean, it's nice in a way to have this chance to get a glimpse of the tone of the game. And, you know, some of the themes, in addition to the more obvious stuff like the mechanics and the controls and all, which have been a lot of, you know, what people have talked about in reviews.
Right.
But, you know, I think, that kind of feel is pretty important to me in this sort of game, if you're going to get something out of it.
I think there is this tremendous sense of just oppressiveness when you play the game that's difficult to sort of quantify. Like, it just feels very much like you're
being built up, just feels like you're being rained on constantly, which, you know, I suppose is probably more disturbing to people outside of Britain.
But, like, there's this, the first sequence is fairly straightforward. It's just a tutorial sequence. You're walking around
the
house.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is tutorial-ish, but the first bit especially, you know, is really just teaching the very basics.
But that first chapter where you're walking through this wooded mountain on your own, and your only accompaniment are sort of these restless spirits that, you know, with seemingly no hand of ghost involved, did take their own lives or were killed in some way. And you're going through this whole environment. It's very, there's something about just a regular enemy, just something in there that is almost comforting, because instead you're being confronted by these apparitions that, you know, maybe you don't even see them. Maybe you just hear this sort of sound of someone screaming, you know, as it like, and the sound of them falling away is it, and you think, oh, and then a half second later there's a thud and you go, oh.
There wasn't a jump scare, but there's a bit where you crawl through, it's before the forest part, where you crawl through one way, and then when you crawl back the other way, you kind of just see the dangling legs of a ghost that's presumably hanged itself.
Yes.
And it doesn't make a bit, it doesn't like, boom, you know, when you know, it's just there, you know, for you to look at. It's not, I'm kind of glad, first of all, I just think there's diminishing returns to the jump stuff, the spring-loaded cat stuff, but also sometimes it's more unsettling if you don't call attention to it and let people notice it themselves.
And if they notice it, there is a mechanic based around, like, can you quickly get the camera up and
get
take a picture
the camera
up
and get some kind of, I assume some sort of bonus for that?
Points.
It's a really weird thing, like all this talking about, and then at the end of the mission, you get a letter grade and all these points and arcade scores. Like, it's like DDR or something.
There's the DDR of death. Thank you, Greg. Because I often didn't get the camera up in time because I was sort of taken aback by what I was seeing.
You're just kind of taking it in as well. But by the time you've like processed it, it's got, I guess, you know, as you play the game, you get more conditioned to those sorts of things. It's not really going to be an issue.
Are there cases where, you know, you would see something, you would take out the camera and it would actually be the wrong thing to do? Like, could you, I don't know, there was something else that was required of you and you messed up?
If you were to take it out when you thought you were seeing just a regular apparition and it was actually an enemy, you could set yourself up in kind of a bad place.
Hmm.
But generally speaking, the enemies have color, whereas the just the sort of ghosts are just kind of semi-translucent. They're very wispy. There's one. So as you're wandering through these woods, you're about 2/3 of the way up the mountain. And this was the situation I was talking about where you heard the sound of somebody jumping and then silence and then a thud. And that's really unsettling for like the next 4 or 5 minutes because that's all you get. There's essentially nothing happens from that point on. You're walking, you're picking up items, which is always dangerous in this game, but
the item thing is amusing because it's like really drawn out. With the setup, like sometimes these ghostly hands are going to come out and grab you while you're doing it. And it's like, it was kind of amusing, for the course of the demo, but.
Yeah,
the entire game, I'm wondering.
So what I'm saying is, you hold down the shoulder button. The shoulder button takes a lot of duty in this game, but you hold down the shoulder button and she'll lean over to pick up an item, but very slowly, like an octogenarian picking up something off the floor. And the reason is occasionally, like very rarely, this ghost hands up and grabs you. So you have to release the button in the right time if you see that happening. And then you can just pick it up and you're fine. But it's so uncommon that you'll never, ever, ever react to it in time because you're just not conditioned to. So instead, there's just these really slow item grabs. But at the end of this climb, you see the top of the waterfall and you think, oh, that's lovely. And then you see the ghost and you see her jump and you go, oh, I feel worse now than I felt before. This is bad. It drags it out where you have to, it's going to make you experience this. Those are the ones that really just pound at you psychologically. And this with the fear of jump scares, which the game does do. I mean, there are.
Oh, yeah. But I feel like sometimes they could have done more, but they didn't, which I'd like. Yeah, probably fewer is better in my view.
There are definitely places where you think, oh, here it is. Like there's this footbridge you have to cross over a stream and you're like, well, I know it's coming now. and then it doesn't. But it's a long bridge, and like every step, you just feel more and more gross. Like, oh, it's gonna happen any second now.
I kind of find it interesting how they handle, like, you've got an environment like this, you know, we were talking about exploring that, which essentially is, you know, a video game version of the Suicide Forest.
Yes.
In Japan. You know, you're trying to make it very organic and it's got to be very dark and all that, but then it's like, well, how do you explore it? And it's got this kind of, it's almost a bit like the Dead Space line, but instead you're following like these sort of the apparitions that are actually kind of helping you know where to go.
Right.
As well.
Sort
so
of sense more, their
more,
past.
More shoulder button duty.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is it doesn't slow you down as much as you might think, because it's kind of like, okay, once it takes you down a certain path, you can kind of run down that path. Then once you get to another fork, you can reactivate the, you know, the Dead Space line, and it will tell you which path to take of the at that branching point, and then you can start running again. You know, so it wasn't. I mean, for all I've heard about, like, it being really clunky or the movement and stuff, it didn't seem objectionable to me.
It is. It is tank controls. I mean,
well,
it is some variant of tank controls.
When you're running, though, you could just use the camera to shift which direction you're running in, and so, you know, as you're kind of rotating it, it's not as bad as I was expecting based on some of the stuff.
I think people just aren't conditioned to tank controls or derivatives of tank controls, because they really have fallen out of vogue post RE4.
Sure.
To me, mechanically, is most difficult about this game is just getting, you know, the motion control, like the AR stuff to do the camera, and then trying to play with the thumbsticks, and the presence of enemies seemingly all around you can be really disorienting. And you don't necessarily feel like there's a, like, you feel like you're going to have to pay the toll. You're going to have to get hit. There's not much you can do, because at least in the early game, when you don't have lots of film, your recharge rate on fire is very long and your actual damage is very low.
Yeah.
And you're sort of just like, well, I have to pay the toll to get through this enemy, and then I'm going to go to the next one, and hopefully I won't lose too much health, and I'll find some healing items and I'll be okay. So, like, that's the place to me where the controls had issues.
Yeah.
When there's two enemies and they're not in the same spot, that's where I feel like it had more difficulty.
Yeah, I find myself kind of coming out of the camera mode, running somewhere to get myself a better angle, and then starting again, rather than like, okay, let's try and track it all the way left or right, or, you know, it just didn't seem, you know, like, you, by the time you did, you probably were going to have got grabbed.
Yeah. I will say that one thing about this game, and we talked about how it can be oppressive and how it can be depressing, and this dichotomy of just like, hey, it's a video game about ghosts, and also it's about the serious psychological issues that go along with one who is willing to take their own life. Just the general, like, spookiness as a game of spook, it's really kind of there in a way that I didn't expect. I want to buy this game, but what worries me is that I'm going to be such a baby. I'm not going to be able to play it. I went and played it in the dark because I'm an idiot. And just like, nope, can't do this. Can't do this at all. This needs to stop.
You got to know your limitations, James.
So, Greg, do you think you're going to take the plunge on this one?
It's definitely something I'm going to be considering. But like I said, the other thing is, like, you know, with a physical thing, you've always got the safety net of trading it in.
Right.
Whereas you don't have that here. So at least, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not going to pay up front for the limited edition. I think probably it's all sold out now anyway, the limited edition. So,
yeah.
Ship sailed. A good horror type of thing is rare. You know, I kind of am a fan of horror stuff to some extent, but so much of it is garbage. Like, not just, you know, not just in the video game, you know, aspect, but, you know, in the media generally, it's just something that I conceptually like in theory, but a lot of the time it's just, you know, not, you know, the predominantly is not that good. So if this, you know, the fact that this seems like it's got, you know, a kernel of something cool going on in that genre is definitely appealing to me, but I'm still kind of, you know, on the fence at this point.
I will say, if you're into the Japanese style of horror, that's what this game is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like it's not about gore or anything like that. Right. You know, it is psychological and creepy and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So speaking of creepy, Greg.
Yep.
Marmek got an upgrade.
Yeah, you know, lots of ghost house levels.
Lots of ghost house levels.
Ooh.
And yeah. Flags. Hey.
Yeah. I mean, so with the update, I've gone back to a couple of levels and spruced them up. Put a couple of checkpoints in there. Two levels that I always kind of wanted checkpoints, really, even though I knew I couldn't have them at the time. But it's just the way those designs kind of evolved. I mean, the one is the Cheese Bridge Justice level, which
that one needed one.
I'm patterning it on an existing level, so that's why it needed a checkpoint to match up with the original level and to, you know, make it more palatable for people to experiment at the end rather than to die once, then have to do it all over again. I'm really happy about that. And then there was the other level that I put the checkpoint in. It was the sort of puzzle ghost house castle fusion thing called Keep Your Chin Up, which
that
was born out of the idea that, oh, when you put Bowser in the clown car, it's kind of like the end of Super Mario World. You know, he throws bombs out of the car and you can throw them back up at him and hurt him. But then it's like, oh God, he takes way too long to die. Like, how could I craft something that's not, you know, painful to play against? And then I come with the idea of getting a power block to kill him, which does it instantly. But then there'd have to be some sort of puzzle around that. And then the whole level became built around that mechanic from Super Mario World of being able to kick things up in the air. You know, and I thought that was apparent from the title and, you know, the design, but you get feedback and apparently it wasn't that apparent.
Well, thankfully the Miiverse gives you very toned down feedback, or
yeah,
people can't really say exactly what's on their mind.
That might have been the one where I post something along the lines of, I wish I could negatively yeah this, or something along those lines, because I was upset, because I knew what I needed to do. That was the worst part, like knowing what you need to do and not being able to do it makes the checkpoints better, because if you know and you just can't execute it, it is...
Yeah, you don't have to worry about stuff like that anymore, you know, the where people just, you know, you might think, well, you know, once you know what to do, people are going to be able to do it every time, you know, but that's not necessarily the case. So, I mean, in general, I kept my levels pretty short-ish, you know, I didn't want them to be that long because of the fact you couldn't have checkpoints, and, you know, just generally probably that's going to be the best way to do it if you're not, like, an actual level designer. At least don't wear out your welcome. But this does allow you at least to kind of go with some more complexity, because the one thing about that level, the with the Bowser at the end in the clown car, is that it was all built around that idea of kicking stuff up in the air, but you had different things being introduced along the way, you know, this kind of learning curve, or, you know, sort of riffing on the same concept. And of course, you know, you can't really do that if the level's super short. You know, that's not something you can't... How much could you cram in a short level? You know, whereas to have the ability to have a theme, you know, which I think is, you know, something that's generally advised for a level. It tends to, you know, knit it together and make it more intuitive and fun. But, you know, to be able to expand on it a bit more without alienating the player now by virtue of using the checkpoints is kind of a big deal. I mean, I know people did, like, come up with some pretty clever ways to, you know, create, you know, de facto checkpoints with the old stuff, you know, but this is a hell of a lot more accessible and applicable, having them actually built into the game. So I think it's going to open up what kind of levels people can make, and I'm looking forward to seeing that, and I might go back to making some more levels myself now that I've just... first of all, taking a pass at improving some of the ones that are already there. But I don't know, I'm not necessarily expected to. I think there's not a lot I've got left in the tank, to be honest. They're not got particularly great feedback on them, and I'm not a good game level designer with Celt Surprise. I think we all already knew that, basically. The good thing though is that I have played Mario Maker an obscene amount. I've played about 1,200 levels.
I've
cleared most of them. I've done the expert thing several times, the 100 Mario shots, because I'm interested in unlocking the amiibo costumes, but because expert was, I found out, the best way to play the game, because it screened out all the autoplay garbage, because that would have too high a completion percentage. And even though, yes, you'd come across, you know, some levels that you'd just gong straight away because it was clearly mean-spirited or just, you know, ridiculously hard. That is where you would actually find some levels that were just genuinely trying to be challenging Mario levels, rather than, oh, it plays music when you run past the blocks, or, you know, this, that little gag levels, or, you know, I mean, it was the best way to play levels that felt like some kind of a Mario-esque challenge. So, you know, that actually, although probably a lot of people have shied away from expert because of the fear of just how badly you're going to get trolled or whatever, and of course there's some of that out there, but, you know, for me, I think it served me quite well. And yeah, there's plenty of times where I didn't reach the end of the 100 Mario challenge, but who cares? I mean, it was just a good way to get levels that weren't going to be autoplay levels, mate. Just essentially screen those out. But now with this update, you've got another way, you know, to screen those out, in terms of you've got these event courses and these like official maker things, which at the moment are just characters, like the pigeon from the manual or the course bar or the Bowser. I beat the Bowser level today, the puzzle dungeon thing, which is not entirely puzzle based. There's a hell of a lot of precision stuff going on in that as well. But I mean, it's really hard, but it's got two checkpoints. The completion is under 1%, impressed with. But you know, like I said, it's got two checkpoints, and there's some questionable decisions. There's some really clever stuff in there. So, you know, if this is more, you know, sort of curated content that's finally going to be sort of delivered to us after, you know, I've done a pretty passable job entertaining myself with the, you know, less than stellar curation that we've had up till now, I could see this is going to have a hell of a lot more legs yet.
Well, if you've played over 1,000 stages, you may well have played over 1% of the levels ever created.
I mean, oh no, they're like into 3 million and all that now.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's.
You're right.
So yeah, I'm not there.
I can math,
but you know, it's. I find it's kind of just endless fun so far, consistently, but you know, you know, every so often you're going to hit stuff that's not very entertaining. But you know, in between those moments, you've just some really clever stuff. You know, and you get to star those people's level, and then you go back to your list of starred levels, and you bring up all the other stuff they've made, and it goes from there. You know, so even before this update, you could find people that you liked. Eventually, if you was willing to put yourself out there, as it were, on expert, I think it's only going to improve now with checkpoints and what we're getting from Nintendo, these event courses where you can unlock amiibo costumes. I mean, they've all been pretty easy, those ones,
yeah.
But still fun, and you know, more costumes is cute and nice and all that, so I'm glad they're gonna keep supporting it. I hope this is only the first of a number of very significant updates.
Well, I promised you more Yoshi.
Oh yes, I haven't heard about this yet. Go on.
They introduced 3 new skinny Mario sprites.
Oh my god, that thing's terrifying enough as it is.
One of them is him riding skinny Yoshi.
Oh wow! Yeah, I've seen.
It is a nightmare.
I've seen a video. Apparently, you can now knock on the doors that you can put in levels. Like if you take your stylus, you knock a couple of times, and you're actually going to see different skinny Marios answer the door.
Oh god!
Yeah.
How did they not have this ready for Halloween with Slender Mario and Slender Yoshi terrify you in your dreams? Bloody hell!
Like I'm pleased though that this game is continuing to get support and you know
it's... Yeah, I think we expected as much, but it's still great to see it happening.
All right, well I want to thank Karen for joining us to talk about some Woolly World.
Great, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was good.
It was fun.
Yep, and
I'd like to come back.
Yeah, we'll make that happen.
Yeah. There's a certain game you have to resume playing.
Oh, that's true. Chrono Trigger.
Oh. Yes. Hasn't this show had enough people play Chrono Trigger under the threat?
I think it was Johnny that really wanted me to play it, though, wasn't he?
Johnny's been the instigator for multiple people having to play this game on
this
show.
Chrono Trigger evangelist. You know, there's two things he evangelizes for, Chrono Trigger and then to balance it out, Mile on Secret Castle.
This is a terrible person. I mean, honestly, like, I don't need to have him on the show to defend himself. He's a terrible person. But on that, after the break, your listener mail.
It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review, Rodea the Sky Soldier on 3DS by Donald Terrio. Guess what? A game that took seemingly a decade to develop, starting on Wii before finally landing on 3DS, Wii U, as well as the original platform, isn't great. On the bright side, the camera is, quote, unusable, which will allow us to preserve the world's dwindling camera supply. We also have a review of Cutie Pets Pick Berries by... You know what? Let's play a game. I'm going to describe this Wii U eShop title, and you tell me who reviewed it. Bipedal deer buffed up like an 80s action star on an aggressive steroid cycle hide behind bushes while the player draws lines between berries in order to, quote, pick them. The deer make a self-satisfied aww noise with each pick. That's right! Don Koopman reviewed John Lindemann's fantasy game about animals with pecs and six-packs. We also have a review of Yo-Kai Watch. Kim Keller delves headfirst into this game about spirits with buttock-shaped heads. Level 5 Cross-Media Champion turns out to be a really good game. See if you're destined to become friends with Jibion and fall into the trap, like so many Japanese people before you. We also have a feature, Part 3 of How Do You Super Mario Maker, put together by Mr. Carmine Red. In this series, we've asked staff and readers about their process for designing Mario Maker levels. Want to know what makes a stealth Mario level? How about the design motivations for a 9-year-old girl? Want to know where Amiibo support is stashed? We have all the info. And maybe it will give you a little inspiration for the now updated Super Mario Maker. And lastly, we have a preview, Stellaglow, by Donald Terrio. We have an in-depth breakdown of Image Epoch's Swan Song. It's not our review, because embargoes. But you should leave with a pretty good idea if you want to get your glow on. You can get your glow on right now, with a lot of content, end-of-year reviews going up every day. That's not a promise. There is review every day. I'm already in trouble. You can go get all of your stuff right now. Everything you could possibly want. As long as what you want is Nintendo-related coverage at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back with the first time in a long time, your listener mail. We actually had a little bit last week, but the proper listener mail segment. And I'm going to call this the no rhyme or reason email grab bag, where normally I try to give these some kind of topical flow, but not this time. Not this time. This time, it's unfiltered your email, where you could send that email to me and to these guys, is rfn at NintendoWorldReport.com. I'll say it again at the end of the show. First up this week, Adolf Vega writes, what's going on with Sony abandoning the Vita and then saying they will continue to support it? Well, third-party support for the Vita has, or had, go to Nintendo with the 3DS / NX portable games. Nintendo's fear of competition copying them seems more apparent in the mobile market. Seriously, several publishers can release Miitomo clones on iOS or Android, and it seems like it could be a hit and fade before Nintendo even releases the game. These are kind of two separate topics.
So I guess we don't want to handle them individually.
Well, the second bit first kind of just leads on from what we were talking about last week, is just how unusual it is that you talk about a mobile app like that months ahead of time. And interestingly, last week it was all like just coming out, on the live blog and all that. We've had some clarification since, like, apparently the whole unannounced stuff this calendar year was a bit of a mistranslation with the live blog or whatever. There isn't anything explicit about that in the actual, content when you read it in English. But another thing come out in the English bit was when the Kimishima and co talked about why they were delaying the launch of the first mobile app, Miitomo. They did actually say, oh, we wanted to do that because we wanted to have a big lead in. Like, this, oh, basically, if we were still going to launch before the end of this year, we would have had to start talking about it like last month or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So apparently this is a central plank of the strategy around this game, talking about it. Decide that that is not in fact the reason why they delayed it, and it might just be incompetence, for the lack of a more diplomatic word. Like I said, it's interesting, this idea, because Nintendo often talks about the fact, oh, well, we can't talk about stuff too early because people will steal it, even when they were talking about the vitality sensor they rolled out that old.
Yeah, I can't tell you about what this thing is.
So it is interesting that they don't really seem to be that afraid of getting plagiarized there. But I imagine they feel like, the Miis and plugging it into the Nintendo account that's coming is really going to be what makes it what it is. So it doesn't matter if you basically rip it off. It's not the same.
Well, yeah, and there's lots of communication things on mobile that come and go. You hear about, like, Snapchat went public for $87 trillion this week, but, like, that's one of a string of apps like that, most of which failed. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like they're doing anything revolutionary from what they announced.
No, I mean, presumably they haven't given away the whole farm or whatever, but yeah, I can't imagine it's going to be something that lives and dies by its sheer inventiveness.
Right. So them waiting for Nintendo account to exist makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot more of the reason behind this. I cannot imagine that they realistically is like, oh no, yeah, we're going to take this hit on the stock price because it's been delayed, because we need months to talk about it ahead of time. That's a smell test.
Maybe they're not so concerned about the gameplay being, or, well, if there is gameplay, I'm not even sure. But maybe they're not too concerned about that, because really what's going to sell this app is probably the Nintendo name more than even the content of the app. Like, no, people are going to be curious.
Even though a lot of the coverage seemed to poo-poo this idea, indirectly at least, the power of the Mii, kind of branding and everything that goes with that, specific just within the Nintendo umbrella. So, no, I mean, I don't think it's a big deal, but their rhetoric about this seems a bit muddled to me. So they're probably covering for something.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo doublespeak is sort of a fine art that you have to learn to really appreciate. It's. It's like a symphony written in a minor key. It sounds discordant, and at first your ear goes, oh! But eventually you learn to pick out the true perfection of what they're saying. Or not saying, really.
Well, that's definitely a comparison that everyone can understand and relate to, for sure.
Well, it was deliberately pretentious. So I actually want... the character that was saying it wants no one to be able to relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Character, sure.
You Philistines. To Mr. Vega's second point, or second question, right?
First point that
answering second.
To the other question, yes. Your order doesn't matter to me, is...
Vita support go to 3DS and X?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think what you... So to back up the statement, Sony is not supporting the Vita anymore, but they can't come out and say, hey, that platform you bought like 3 years ago...
No, they're never gonna say that. Just to, like, do themselves out of some benefit.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, essentially, they are not doing anything to drive sales of it or anything like that. I mean, but you know, a lot of, you know, indie stuff and you know whatnot, because certain console type of games appear on there, and I would expect that to be the kind of thing that could hopefully be on NX in the future. Because you know, hopefully Nintendo keep working with indie develop, you know, sort of cultivating those relationships and all that kind of stuff, and yeah, the hardware should be suitable, I would imagine. I mean, they're right, trying to get Unity working, but they have got Unity working on
the new 3DS.
Yeah, so I mean, you'd think that'd be a given for NX.
Unity will be on NX.
It's on Wii U, new 3DS, so all that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, I think you should see those sorts of games appearing on Nintendo.
Especially if it's easy. Like, if it's easy to say.
No,
okay.
and hopefully that's part of the whole project, is just making it as easy as possible.
Right. Well, like the support for Vita, though, I've seen a lot of developers on Twitter are kind of sour on it. It seems like originally a lot of them signed on because it seemed like too crazy to pass on it. Like it was too good a deal to not do it. And so a lot of people signed on, but then the Axiom Verge developer, amongst others, discovered that it's not as easy as flipping a Switch, and maybe the return on the investment is not going to be as high as perhaps he had anticipated.
So that could probably be more of a kind of catalyst for them moving away from that than whatever Sony's doing with its first party software.
Right. I think there's already a movement, you know, that indies going away from the Vita, just because of development problems and because it's not a portable PlayStation 3. Like it doesn't work that way. It's not, you know, it's got certain power issues, that, you know, we can hope that the NX won't have.
So I would say the other branch of support for the Vita is the kind of mid-level or smaller hyper-Japanese development studios.
Niche, pervy RPG makers.
They're not all pervy, but there is certainly a thread of that. And we have seen some of those show up on 3DS relatively recently.
We sure have, yeah.
And some of those, like Senran Kagura, you know, I was talking about this with our friend of the show, Seren McNulty, the other day, about this question, because I wanted to get kind of an outsider's opinion. Somebody who deals with all of these platforms fairly regularly. And we kind of agreed that if the Vita had hit PSP sale numbers, Senran Kagura never comes out on Nintendo 3DS. Like, that goes straight to Vita, and that's just where it lives.
That's the thing. I mean, the Vita at least exists in Japan, so it does have that mid-level kind of support. But obviously, PSP played second fiddle to DS, which was just ridiculous, but it reached really big numbers, so it was a very healthy kind of eventually. It took a while to get there.
Didn't the Xbox 360 get a lot of those games?
It did, but that's because they were super easy to make. Okay. And they developed sort of like a... There was this audience in Japan that owned 360s because they knew that's where that stuff was.
Right. So, wouldn't those same people have picked up a Vita? And wouldn't surely the Vita user base in Japan is bigger than the Xbox 360 user base.
It's extant.
The challenge is, at some point, do those people who have Vitas just stop buying games for Vitas? Or is it easy to put games out for Vita? Because I can tell you right now, at least in North America, Target did a big sell-off of their Vita games. Like, they have crushed their Vita space down to, like, one column of games at this point.
No, and it never really got going that much anyway, you know, so I mean, but Japan's a very different thing. There are spin-offs of those Senran.
Spin-offs. But at some point, like, do people just stop caring about the Vita? Is it so out of the mind space that it doesn't... It doesn't make sense to put your game there anymore, to put new games there anymore. And I think that's, you know, we're not there yet, even in Japan, but I think it will start to shift that way, especially if NX is easy to put games on and does well out of the gate. Because at some point you're going to be trying to sell on the... It's better to try to put your game on a new platform.
Well, especially in Japan, you would expect it to be positioned as the, you know, successor to the throne of the 3DS, which is the most popular platform in Japan. So you'd certainly expect it to mop up a lot of that Japanese type of stuff, as 3DS has done to some extent, but then maybe,
you know, some more things that are more technically advanced, you know, that could be easy ports or that sort of thing for Japanese developers to do. And I mean, as far as we could tell, there isn't going to be another Sony portable.
No,
no,
I can't fathom.
Sony has kind of been clear about that. They've been saying like, well, the time is not really good for mobile.
Yeah. VR is their new thing at this point.
Yeah,
so well, that bodes badly for them. I mean,
they're new.
Well, but you know, I mean, I think Nintendo should have, you know, that sort of mainstream Japan sort of gaming scene almost to itself.
I mean,
to whatever's left of it, I guess, is the question.
I would say that the one to not speak of, like these weird like low end Japanese games. The other place where you can look at see that the shift already started is Monster Hunter. That Nintendo or that Capcom said, you know what? Let's not put these on Vita.
I think Nintendo pushed for that.
I'm sure they did.
I'm not sure what exactly went the other way, but let's not forget that happened at a time where 3DS was off to a rocky start and was, you know, probably along with the price cut and the ambassador program.
That's true.
The various other things that they did was one thing that probably helped it. Ensure that it would be, you know, if not the roaring success of DS, a successful and the premier platform out there in Japan. And I really struggle to think that will change in the next cycle with NX. I think it will. So you'll get a lot of that kind of stuff too. And, you know, hopefully they, I mean, the indie side is a bit less certain, but hopefully they'll get that. And I think that's a decent sort of tranche of software right there, like that you'd be able to play on NX that you probably wouldn't get a lot of other places necessarily, especially, you know, in that particular way. If you're somebody that does like a dedicated portable, hopefully that's what it's going to deliver for you.
So we're all in agreement that NX is your home for the next Galgun game. Perfect.
I don't.
Next email. Guillaume?
Yes. Bite the pillow.
Mr.
Writes,
the pillow.
Yes. Serious question for you. Do you think that a hand-drawn picture of that guy in Yokai Watch with a pink nutsack for a head wearing a mushroom hat would get moderated on Miiverse? Thanks for addressing important issues like this on your podcast. And since we are back on NX stuff, do you think that Nintendo might get in on streaming game action like Sony has with PS Now, even adding smart TV compatibility with certain Samsung models? Or could they make something like the Amazon Fire TV Stick? And that's the end of the... That's the end of the email.
Well, let's handle the first testicle-related question.
Do you mean there's other testicle-related questions?
I always have testicle-related questions, but... In the context of Mr. the Pillow's email, I think you can make a compelling case if they tried to moderate you that I am featuring a Nintendo published character in my drawing in appreciation for this fine masterwork of monster battling that you have created. This is a testament to my love of the franchise, as I call them. But I would strongly advise against putting those on, like, the Wii Sports Club message board. Probably want to keep them to Yokai Watch. Just a thought.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange situation, because normally when there's problematic imagery in a game, Nintendo just doesn't allow the screenshot feature. They did in Bayonetta 2, which is kind of surprising, but I mean, in... Shin Megami Tensei 4, there were many moments where I was like, oh, I want to take a screenshot of this dialogue because it's pretty funny.
Oh, I thought you were going to say this penis, you know, monster.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I can't, you know, share dialogue in the game because, yes, there is a chariot penis monster in the game. So they just disabled the whole thing, right? Or it's the same thing with the Angry Video Game Nerd game, like you can't take screenshots or something, or they didn't feature, I'm not even sure if it's got Miiverse. Anyway, I don't have the game. So will Nintendo have the same treatment for a kid's RPG featuring a monster that apparently looks like, you know...
See, I don't like the word problematic. I think it's an opportunity to teach children about different cultures. I mean, ultimately,
this kinda, you would be in favor of keeping the giant gonads on...
I am pro testicles, yes.
I see. Okay.
I am strongly opposed to the forces that want to remove testicles in general. I think right. that is a bad philosophical statement to be making to our children.
What is that, right? Tanuki. It's Tanuki.
Yeah,
right?
Tanuki. Okay. Yeah. The
maybe actually Steve maybe this is the start of something wonderful. Maybe we'll see.
Testicles. Tanuki Mario. Start of something wonderful.
Maybe they'll bring some much needed changes to the Tanuki Mario suit.
Yeah, it can fly, but then it can also be like a space hopper.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there we go. Done. Oh, like there's so many episode titles for it just in this one conversation. I would say that
because it's a serious question, right? Take it seriously. Would it get moderated or not?
I think
we've established the fact that if you facetiously call someone a jerk for the level design, it gets moderated.
That was really surprising.
If we try and sort of, you know, make these some kind of common currency here in terms of objectionableness, how can we rank them?
But you're not calling the testicles a jerk. You're appreciating.
Yeah, that's true. No, but you're even, you know, like very.
If you drew it and then said you are a jerk bollockhead. Then it would be a problem.
Then you're done. You're out.
Well, you know, there's Phil Theobald from the Player One podcast who's been, for a while, he was drawing cupcakes or, you know, like very innocent looking twirly stuff on Miiverse that some people apparently interpreted as turds. And that got moderated. Yeah. So it didn't matter what context, like what extra details
the
he brought around the picture.
Test.
Yeah, exactly. That was not kosher.
I think that says more about the moderator than it does about Phil Theobald. I think that moderator. Exactly.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess it's if people flag it, though, is it really so much at the discretion of the moderator? It's like, oh, I don't find this offensive, but some people do, so we better take it away.
But
so
well,
really,
and
it depends on if people flag the picture of that Yo-Kai Watch character. Then
in that case, I'm going to need to petition the ESRB to review Yo-Kai Watch's rating. Because I don't want my children exposed to their own testicles. Sorry, to testicles. My mistake. I will make them wear protective shields they cannot see below their own waist.
It's just an airline food tray stapled.
this is a fantastic thing. Like we have an email about this. It's not going to be in this week, but it was a question about. In a lot of ways, localization and dealing with things that are culturally non-issue in Japan that are an issue here. And this is one of those ones where, like, I'm glad Nintendo just said, oh, just deal with it. We'll just deal with the fact that he looks like the joke that Microsoft didn't get in the name Grabbed by the Ghoulies. I just appreciate that at some point somebody looked at their situation and said, well, we can't win this one. But I really hope beyond hope that Hasbro goes full feature on the toys line and gets a toy for this one on store shelves. Because that's the point where I would just, first off, I'd buy it. And secondly, I would just laugh for days. Just, that would be my new business for the next week. Hmm. Oh.
By the way, can you tell me what the name of that character is so that I don't have to type Yo-Kai Watch Pink Nutsack?
You know what?
To find the
you know what?
For the chapter up.
Yeah.
I think this is awesome. Google actually not a successful search there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We'll deal with it. All right. Cool. So the other part of his email. The less serious part of his email.
Yep.
The non human health part of his email. I can't remember what it was.
Streaming.
Yes, streaming. So no. Honestly, I just don't see that Nintendo is going to feel comfortable doing streaming. At least not this generation.
Or the next. Or next one. Basically, like five generations after everyone else has done it, maybe. But
so I seem to recall Johnny talking about this when he was on the show. I mostly just blanked all that out.
They have. I guess part of the crux of it was the idea that, you know, they obviously sank a lot of kind of research and all that into getting, you know, the responsiveness up there for the Wii U streaming, you know, that kind of stuff. So, because that's the thing. I mean, with the Wii U, you might think, well, the lag would be a real issue with that cutting it off TV play and all that. But
that's a very different thing.
No, it is a very different thing. But I think that's part of, you know, the kernel of what Johnny was getting at, that they have done research in some of these sorts of areas. So maybe it is something that could pay off for them in other, you know, in other ways, if they ever wanted to kind of go back to that, where, you know, to make more out of the whatever sort of progress they made in that area working on the Wii U concept. So I wouldn't rule it out altogether, but perhaps not anything that seems imminent. I think it's going to be, hopefully, you know, this Nintendo account business is going to be a step in the right direction in terms of not having everything content wise just being anchored to one single device. You know, but at the same time, I can't see it getting to a point where we're talking about smart TV compatibility. You know, we're still going to be talking about some kind of basis in a Nintendo device, one of a family of devices, you know.
Well, and I think the other thing to keep in mind is that what would Nintendo's net gain be here versus something where you just download a thing? And the answer would be, well, you don't have to worry about device compatibility.
Yeah.
Which they've done they don't seem to have to care anyway. So, I mean, it's fine. Like, they just, there is an advantage there. I just don't know that to them having to the cost to maintain a streaming service is worth it versus just saying, download this thing. You're fine.
No, as I said, I think for the time being, you know, we've had these issues with Nintendo's device specificity, you know, in terms of having Wii U with 3DS being separate and all that. You know, maybe they haven't ended up getting as much profit out of their software development because it's getting split between the two. Maybe there's some redundancy. Obviously, you've seen that we're all merging together. So you come into a point where, yeah, the devices, the Nintendo devices are not going to be as specific, and they'll get, you know, that should hopefully help them with software development and making money off software. But I still think they like making devices. You know, they still like being a hardware maker at this point. You know, so I can't see them, you know, that would be another few steps along if this rethink doesn't pan out the way they're hoping it will. You know, the just sort of paring it down to, you know, one family of Nintendo devices and one Nintendo account that kind of links it all together. You know, if that doesn't deliver the results that they're looking for, perhaps this is something they'd consider.
And I'm just not sure that streaming is the way of the future for video games. I don't know how it is in your countries, but in Canada, we certainly have bandwidth caps. And right. We've recently here cut cable, so we're watching all of our TV off the internet, and we can only manage that because I set Netflix to SD.
Oh, I see.
So, and we also, you know, we manage TV consumption by playing video games instead. So if my video game playing becomes, you know, streaming on the internet, then I'm kind of boned. I'll have to pay more for the internet. And I think that in the US too, like they're like Verizon, or like they're kind of testing in certain markets, putting bandwidth caps and
One thing we have here to our advantage is that if they were to put bandwidth caps, people would just jump to the other provider, because we usually have two if you live in a city, or three, and they work on this kind of such cutthroat on each other that they would, that like if you were to make that move, the other one would stab you in the back so fast that you can't. That essentially, they've got knives to each other's neck, daring them to be the first one to attempt bandwidth caps. So, like, I don't have a bandwidth cap. I have, you know, I have blazing internet, and it's as much as I want to use
it. Yeah,
I
said bandwidth. I meant download.
Yeah, I know. And I could set that thing to download 24 hours a day, but I don't want to. Like, if my internet's out, I don't want to not be able to play video games. I think for Nintendo, especially because they still are leveraged so heavily on mobile games, I think streaming for them would be, you know, if they could do it reliably and cheaply and not have to worry about all this stuff, I think they'd be fine with it. But even compare it to Canada, some of the markets they may be targeting for this device may be in even crazier internet shape, where it's more difficult to manage your internet usage. I know.
No, I mean, I think infrastructurally, yeah, there's plenty of places in the world that are far away from, you know, the kind of future where you could have this stuff be like complete, like forget about it, you know, just like don't worry about it in terms of bandwidth and caps and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you know, some people still consume a hell of a lot of stuff streaming.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, with you know, the necessarily be the only way they consume media, but they consume it, a lot of it streaming, so it's not as if you couldn't have something at the minute, but I don't see Nintendo kind of getting into that until, you know, as kind of Guillaume mentioned, maybe like five, you know, cycles down the line, but certainly, you know, at some significant period of time after this new model that they're kind of adopting has had a chance to, you know, see what works and what doesn't in terms of how people consume their content and whatnot.
Yeah. But it would be a difficult thing for them to get, you know, to get there to, I think. And we as consumers would have to adjust what our understanding of games are, because at that point you don't own your game anymore. You definitely don't own your game anymore. And those servers can go away any time. See GameTap, which did something very similar, and I had membership there and then it went away. And I had no recourse. It was just gone.
Right. GameTap was not streaming though. You downloaded
there were some things that they didn't, they kinda streamed. They played in your browser window essentially.
Okay.
And those all vanished. Now, a lot of those were older games, but it was just like, oh, all right, well, they're gone now, I guess. Whatever. But if that was my Nintendo collection of games, I would be furious. And I will say that, you know, Sony is still very much testing the waters on that product. I don't think they've figured out a pricing model that works. I mean, generally speaking, when I ask people about it who have it, like, pricing is just completely screwed up. And I think it was more a technical experiment than anything. And maybe in the future, but not right now. And Guillaume, to make you feel better, I sent you. I don't think it looks like testicles. It looks like a butt, because he's got brown smoke coming out of his mouth.
Is that smoke or is that fire?
I mean, it looks like he's farting.
Hmm.
So okay. I would argue it's more of a butt. But, you know, again, testicles are in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
Greg, okay. Next email.
On that, Dan from Canada. That's very specific. Right.
The Dan from Canada.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that Dan. One. Yeah, you know him, right, Gil?
Yeah, of course.
Just like I know Jude Law or whatever. with the release of Triforce Heroes, it will mark the fourth Zelda game since Skyward Sword. What elements from these four games would you like to see more of in Zelda for Wii U? Wind Waker HD gamepad controls? Miiverse integration, Majora's Mask time element /fast-forwarding by the hour, a link between worlds weapon rental, wall mechanic, Triforce Hero costumes, or deep down, do all of you just want a true sequel to 2012's Legend of Zelda Battle Quest from Nintendo Land? Love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, man. I had a deep
shit. I quite like Battle Quest. It's fun.
Yeah, it's actually kind of fun.
Yeah, like, it's pretty good.
I didn't think much of it until I got to play it with some people, and then, oh, this is amusing now. Cause there's something about your archer partner just shooting you in the back by accident, and they're going, I'm sorry! You're just like going, oh, damn it.
Like, I only ever played it with one other person, so I don't know if this changed with more players, but the fight against Ganon was quite hard at the end.
It is very difficult.
I was pretty surprised that they went there, you know, in something like that.
In such a bizarre game. Yeah, I mean, I am not going to use this as an opportunity to remind people how bad Link Between Worlds is, but
you're not going to make your opponent's youth and inexperience an issue in this election.
I would.
James is the Gipper.
One part of Skyward Sword I really liked. You know, there's definitely some stylistic things I loved about that game. That game had moments down, and by moments I mean like the desert ship. Yeah, I'm blanking on what it was called.
Great.
Just these moments of just pure impact where you thought, oh, this is really cool. Twilight Princess, we talked about it, had one where you walked into the Temple of Time for the first time.
Yep.
And, well, no, when you realized you were in the Temple of Time.
When you go back there after you go there to take the Master Sword, but then you come back,
right?
And you see it in a different way.
Yeah, because it's just ruins before.
Yeah, exactly. So, and of course, Wind Waker under the sea. I mean, it's something that you always hope for in intend to find in the next major console Zelda.
Right, but I think
personally love Link Between Worlds, but it doesn't. I don't think it was ever going to deliver a moment like that.
No,
sort of genuine wonder.
But I think Skyward Sword delivered quite a few of them.
I would go along with that.
For a game that we kind of chastise for being not very open.
It's flawed, but, there's some repetition and tedium in it, but, that you can recognize that without,
And there's a giant thumb with feet.
Yes, without diminishing, everything that's really good about the game. In terms of some of the specifics that Dan mentions, I think, well, certainly, Wind Waker HD's gamepad controls and Miiverse, I think, should be pretty much a lock.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I did enjoy that part of Wind Waker HD a great deal, actually. I felt like it was more fluid and sped things up. Not, obviously the sailing got sped up in a very literal way, but just that being able to aim like that, I liked it in the 3DS games as well, actually, mm-hmm. even though a lot of people, with the wall, it breaks the 3D effects. So I often use gyro because it's quicker.
I wonder if that's better on a new 3DS.
Yeah, like, it is.
Okay.
I played a bit of Majora's Mask on new 3DS, and the super stable 3D does its job.
Well named.
As the Zelda hater of the group, I haven't played really much of these remakes, and I haven't played Link Between Worlds. I actually sent back the two copies that I had received. After...
Oh, you mean Triforce Heroes?
Triforce Heroes, sorry.
Why did you buy two copies?
Triforce Heroes. Like, it didn't sound, from Greg's description, that didn't sound like the experience that I wanted. Where was I going with this?
You're talking about how you hate Zelda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So Guillaume wants the game to get canceled.
No, but the Link Between Worlds, I think the generous amount of warp points is definitely something I want to see more of in a Zelda game. Like, there were three of them in Link's Awakening. Not really enough. You could warp to every temple in Ocarina of Time, but I think there were so many of those. There were tons of weather vanes exactly where you needed them, where you needed to teleport frequently, so... definitely, like, user friendliness in general, bring that to the next Zelda.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, though. This, if we go along with the notion that it's going to be this big open world, like, that's pretty much mm-hmm. what we know about the game, as they've talked about that. I think the first thing we could take from that is the idea of a Majora's Mask time element is almost certainly out. Because for me, the whole point of what makes that work is the fact that it's quite tightly scripted. Everything,
right.
and how do you script a vast open world? Mm-hmm. I think you kind of take it away from the whole point of it. The whole is not script. You're going out and into the great unknown and finding whatever you find. I mean, if it's truly is going to be vast, to have like it actually be somewhat interesting, but then also have all these things be plotted out, it just seems like that's unworkable to me. It would have to be something very much diluted from, because Majora's Mask is a small world, even compared to Ocarina of Time. It's quite small in many ways, and that's what allows them to, script everything that happens and make it feel alive in that way. And I just don't think that's the approach they're going for. They're not going for a weird little side story, thing at the end of a cycle, where this is meant to be the grand culmination, the next big Zelda, mm-hmm. that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, and just to your point, like, we do have an example of a huge world where there's not scripted stuff, but there are characters in certain places at very specific times, and that's Xenoblade. And it doesn't really work that well, because the world that you're exploring, the towns are so vast, so huge, that you're always going to be missing people. Like you can't just walk around and expect to find the person you're looking for. You have to know exactly that they're going to be there between this time and that time. And you end up missing out on a ton of quests because of that. So yeah, the bigger the world, then the less fun it becomes. And you don't really, I think that in a bigger Zelda game, just day and night cycles are enough. You know, you explore the town during the day, you explore it during the night. Some people are out when they were locked inside earlier. Yeah, and, fine.
I would expect that feature, but that probably could be the extent of it.
It's funny that you bring up Xenoblade, because I was going to bring it up in the context of this open world thing in the opposite of... There is this kind of sense of discovery in that game that it feeds on by giving you experience for it, but also just because, you know, I talk about the spectacle, but that game, you know, you want to get around the next corner because you want to see what's over there.
Yep.
You want to go over the hill. And I think that's vitally important for what Zelda is, because Zelda as a series has always been about the adventure, about, you know, going to that next spot and seeing what's there. And I think if you're going to open that game world up and say, well, you can see over there, now you can go over there too, that's important that when I get there, there's a damn good reason for me to be there. There's something for me to have made the effort, because I remember like the 12 to 15 minute swim in Xenoblade at the falls, where you could swim all the way to the falls, and it took forever. But there was a reward there. Like, I can't imagine, but maybe 1% of the people who played that game made it all the way up. Most of them, because for a while, it looked like you weren't even getting closer. Like, oh, is this a static background?
Is this a visual trick?
Then eventually you reach it and you get there, and it's not much. And you don't have to swim back, thank God, because you can warp. But, the reward for getting there was enough. And I think some way to generate that explore, experience, reward, feedback loop is important, and I would love to see it.
Yeah, because I tell you, the thing is, it might be more important to have a tangible reward in this Zelda than it was in Xenoblade, because for me, one of the things about Xenoblade was just seeing it, because it was it wasn't just like, a fantasy world. That extra sort of sci-fi element to it, the whole being on the body of a god and all that, like, it was, I don't know, that it felt more like anything could be coming up, you know, when you end up, you're journeying around a severed arm in the ocean and stuff like that, you know, like, that is not going to be in Zelda.
Right.
We're never going to see, like, it's never going to be that interesting if it in any way resembles any of the high rules that we've ever been in before.
Right.
You're not going to have, going up onto, the back of the thing and going through its lungs and going across the sword to the other one and all, like, it's just not going to be that interesting. I can't imagine that. So you kind of have to, it might incentivize the exploration a little bit more explicitly rather than just, God, I want to see what crazy stuff they've, done next.
The solution is easy. You do like in Twilight Princess and you put some rupees in
rupees that
in
you
a
don't
treasure
have room.
Chest and
don't have room for in your wallet, you mean?
I would actually say one of the games he mentions, Wind Waker, handles this a little bit, because that game is open. It does have that big exploration element to it, and there are these like little mini dungeons that you may not ever need to go into that you may just stumble across by trying to map all the islands. And I think, like, I want to see what's up on top of that mountain, and you get there and it's, you wouldn't expect like Helm's Deep, but maybe there's like an old fortress up there that there's something in. And maybe it's not much, but you go up there, you fight whatever abomination has been left to guard this place, and you get whatever they're protecting. Like, that may be enough. Just to say,
yeah,
the climb
it's tricky.
Worth it.
You know, I mean, some of it is about the ease of travel. You know, to speak to that point, I mean, how well, because it's an interesting sort of thing to straddle. On the one hand, making the world feel grand and vast, majestic, even, but at the same time, you don't want it to take forever to get around. I mean, obviously, warping comes into that, but if you're just warping everywhere, it doesn't. You know, it kind of somewhat diminishes the sense of the great contiguous environment. Like I said, with Wind Waker, I didn't really, when I played it on GameCube, I didn't really feel like those rewards justified me mapping out the whole map, you know, all the islands on the grid. But when I played it on Wii U, the Swift sail and having the gamepad and all that, I did everything because it was just easier. So I think, you know, that speaks to the fact that, you know, those whatever rewards they have for exploration need to be kind of calibrated according to, you know, how much you out of your way, so to speak, you have to go to get to that particular point. You know, so the more kind of obscure you places, you know, maybe somewhere that some people might not even think you could go, you know, a little bit like some of these places we talk about, Xenoblade, hopefully, you know, not just have something to acknowledge the fact that you did it, but maybe something that really makes you feel like, yeah, it is worth going out of your way in this Zelda game, because it will be something cool. But at the same time, presumably it can't be something that's integral to progression, because, you know, that's not everybody's going to do it. So yeah, it's a really tough balancing act there. And I mean, the only thing, like, in terms of stuff that's coming into Zelda in these games since Skyward Sword that, you know, could feature here, loot is something they're starting to mess with. It was in Link Between Worlds a little bit, pretty trivial. It was sort of like for crafting potions and stuff, wasn't it? I scarcely even remember what you.
Well, actually, it shows up in back in Wind Waker.
No, that's true. Yeah, Wind Waker, you could go back to there. You had those little things, but then that kind of got scaled back. But they seem to be, you know, liking this idea now. You know, because like I said, it was in Link Between Worlds, and then it's, you know, come back in a rather more relevant and central way in Triforce Heroes. In terms of that's a reward for completing a level, and then you're crafting these outfits and stuff. So that might be something that you're looking at there. That, you know, these exploring far off places might not be anything that's really, it's not going to get you, you know, the hookshot or something that is, you know, a significant extension to your abilities and needed for puzzle solving and this, that, and the other, but it might get you some kind of cool gear that just gives you some sort of a buff, or, you know, or is a rare material that goes into that, kind of, so, you know, that kind of more RPG, crafting type of stuff might feel, you know, it seems like it's sneaking in a little bit. I doubt it'd be anything that arcane, but you know, something in that general kind of scene that could be something we see that trend continue.
And step away from the open world stuff briefly, before we probably want to move on. I want to see more of the puzzles being ingrained in the core gameplay mechanic, like we saw in Skyward Sword. Like that, like there was the puzzles in that game actually required me to stop and think a few times, especially in the boss battles, how they worked.
Well, they weren't too item specific,
right?
I think because that was it. Obviously you got items in dungeons, they were very important, but they tried to make it more like, you know, about this item is not just the hammer dungeon.
Right.
And of course Link Between Worlds, it very much was the hammer dungeon.
Right, because you literally bought the hammer to go do that dungeon.
Yeah, you had to get in there, and you might not have anything else. So, right. Yeah, that's the way that pad that. So, you know, they've been all over the map. You know, like, where is it more item-specific or less item-specific? Like, there isn't, like, a distinct direction of travel we can really tell there. I would probably side with you on this one, though. I mean, I like A Link Between Worlds a lot, but I felt that was limiting. It was one of the downsides of that idea of having the weapon rental work like that. There were some nice things about it. I think it made sense in the context of Link Between Worlds because that was a game that was using a world you already knew if you played Link to the Past.
I see.
So the point being that in a way the world, you know, it kind of feels silly walling that off because you already know it. You know, you're not exploring it like from the, you know, from zero. You're not kind of learning it for the first time. You know, you already have this. No, so many people that would have played the game already have this knowledge. It's nice to kind of give it more of a freshen up by having this more non-linear structure and with the weapons and all that. But, you know, what we're hoping for from this Zelda is it's going to be a real, you know, truly most magnificent and sort of engaging overworld in a Zelda game yet. And, you know, I think it would help to design in the design of that if you kind of have a better idea of like, okay, people are going to, even though it's a big open world, there's certain abilities and you know, there's certain likelihood about they're going to go to these places first, and it kind of opens out that way. You know, it gives you more options with the design, I think, rather than limiting yourself with this, you know, item specific dungeons and all that.
Yeah. Well, Guillaume, you got anything else you wanted to mention on this one?
No, not really. I'm just want to be surprised by next Zelda, and also I need to go back to and finish Skyward Sword.
Definitely. I think there are certain, that game is certainly worth seeing through to the end, even though I might have been the strongest person on the show going like, ugh, at things in this game. One last thing I want to say, a release date, please. All the other games have release dates. Can this game have a release date also?
Can they stick to it?
It's true.
That's the other part of it. But no, I mean, I'm open-minded, you know. I mean, I haven't really strongly disliked any of these approaches that they've tried. So, I mean, I'm not too fearful, but I think there's a chance with it being more open. If it truly is more, it depends, you know, that, and they say like, well, you know, maybe our open world's a little bit different from everyone else's and stuff. So you don't want to prejudge this too much, but, I think there's a chance that if it really is kind of more nonlinear, that you might get something a bit like A Link Between Worlds weapon rental, but
ugh.
I hope they do something to make the dungeons less, you know, item.
Every puzzle is solved with this item.
With one item and the wall mechanic. You know, those are the two things you had pretty much to solve anything. So, hopefully they could at least broaden the design out, a little more than that. Especially, you know, you were working with the blank canvas in this game rather than this sort of weird remix adaptation thing of a classic game, the way you were with Link Between Worlds.
Excellent. I think that's going to do it for this week. I want to thank Karen again for joining us to talk about some Yoshi's Woolly World. If you want to send your email for our triumphant return on episode 453, you can send them to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Plugs. I'm working on a Mario Maker video that I'll actually probably use the extra time we have between episodes to finish up playing your levels. I put out a call for them. You're all monsters. All of you. Every last one. He's a terrible monster. But I'm working through it. I did not promise to beat your levels, and there have been some I definitely said nope. So look forward to my suffering. And it should be interesting. We are going to be moving closer to end of the year stuff. So the schedule's gonna get a little different going forward. Bear with us, you know, it's sometimes hard to plan episode recordings during the holidays, and that also means at some point we're going to have to deal with our games of the year, and I hate that, so look forward to that. So be sure to send us your questions, thoughts, and emails, and we will use them to delay having to do the unpleasant as long as we can. Additionally, Nintendo World Report is still planning the telethon. I know we missed our target window for that one. Early December is looking like what we are aiming for. I am going to follow up with our site director, Neil, to get that moving and make sure that we are in good position to deliver on that, because we enjoy interacting with you all when you're not being monsters. And we also enjoy helping children who could really use it. So look out for more details on that. When we have details, we will definitely announce it to you on the show. And I think that's going to do it, unless you guys have anything.
My levels now with checkpoints. Well, not all of them, obviously.
That's true.
Some of them were too short to justify it. But
my levels with checkpoints could also be an episode title. We've had a lot. Unfortunately, most of them are testicle related, so I don't feel good about it.
Yeah. So, you know, if you got scared off before, maybe give it another go now by one of the two that I mentioned, the new business.
That's going to do it for episode 452. This week's musical selection, because you can't email them in or post them in our talkback threads or on the NeoGAF thread, is from Dingens. I hope I pronounced your screen name right. If I didn't, I apologize. And it's Evergreen from Terranigma, the Super Nintendo game that North America didn't get. We didn't get it, right? Or am I thinking of a different game?
No, we never got it.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I actually enjoyed this one. So, on that, bye everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Oh, the other one they have is they put out the totem links.
Yeah, yeah,
which is cool because the music that it plays is the totem link theme, or is the 8-bit demake of the really fantastic theme for that game.
Goodness gracious me, I didn't mention this last week, but that soundtrack is sumptuous. It's so good.
There's actually a video on there. First off, the Japanese Nintendo YouTube page is fantastic. Like, it's definitely worth, even if you don't understand it, it is over the moon amazing. But they posted a bunch of videos of all of these new Super Mario Maker, or not all of them, but some of them, the new special mushroom ones. And they're basically running the same stage, all of them. It's just what comes out of the box at the start. And the Arno one's really good. The one for the Totem Link's really good. But then on the related for the Totem Link video, was just this video that they posted to their Japanese account of them doing the theme for that game, and I almost broke down and bought it right there. Like just
the actual show in them recording it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that video. And I mean, the music of that game is fantastic.